You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of conventional wisdom about race and class in America and what people think about those topics is oversimplified or just plain wrong. That's according to our guest, who says things are more complicated than political parties believe. First, former Governor Tommy Thompson joined the show earlier this week to support part of the new NAFTA deal that he says could spur medical innovation. That provision would increase the time biologic drug makers don't have to compete with generic drugs in Canada and Mexico, giving them exclusive rights in the market. But our next guest says that argument just protects drug companies and what he calls their monopolies, which in turn means higher drug prices. Jonathan Kimball is Vice President of Trade and International Affairs at the Association for Accessible Medicines, a trade group that represents generic drug makers. Jonathan, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, you don't support this provision of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. Tell us why that is.
So the provision would lock in a period of monopoly protection for pharmaceutical brand manufacturers for 10 years and would limit and really handcuff the ability of the United States Congress to use to address the pharmaceutical pricing issue in the United States by limiting their ability to reduce the monopoly rights of the branded pharmaceutical industry below 10 years.
I want to give a listen to former Governor Tommy Thompson when he talked with us. He's working with the PASS USMCA Coalition. Here's what he told us on Monday about why this is needed.
It's expensive to develop these biologic drugs, and it takes a long period of time. So they need some time in which they can sell without competition in order to recoup and recover their huge investments.
So this helps incentivize research into new helpful biologic drugs. What do you say to that?
I mean, monopoly protection the government provides to the pharmaceutical industry definitely incentivizes research. The question is how much of that monopoly protection is needed to incentivize that research. When you look at the world's best-selling drug, this drug Humira, it first came into the U.S. market in 2003 and last year made $19 billion. So how many years do you need to provide this monopoly protection? We think that you don't need to continue to enshrine such a long period in a trade agreement, because that agreement, again, is going to handcuff what Congress can do to address the pharmaceutical pricing crisis here in the United States.
Now, Governor Thompson was focusing on these biologic drugs. Can you talk about what those are?
Sure. Biologic drugs are some of the most advanced medicines that have come to the market recently, and they're based on years of research and development. Now, what's interesting is it does take time, and back in 2009, when Congress provided monopoly protection for these biologics, they said, okay, if you look at how long it takes to bring a drug to the market, we think 12 years of protection is enough. But what is interesting is since then, not only are the drugs coming out very innovative, but companies are using more and more innovative processes to actually bring those drugs to market. So you're seeing greater uses of artificial intelligence, of something called biomarkers, or even mobile technology in the research and development process. And all of that is making R&D faster and should be making it less expensive. And so the government should actually then think about how do we evolve the monopoly powers that we give to these companies so they don't have to continue to charge high prices for such a long period of time. We think that by providing Congress the flexibility to reduce that period, you're actually going to save patients and save our healthcare system a lot of money.
Right, that the current U.S. policy is a 12-year monopoly. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement would require all three participating countries to have this 10-year agreement, so that, or as a minimum. That doesn't really change anything here then, does it?
No, but what it will do is it will lock in that period of protection in the United States to 10 years. We are at a time when Congress, the White House, and really the American population is debating how do we address the high price of drugs in the United States. And it just seems like it would be a foolish mistake for us to lock in a period when not only do we not know what the right answer is here in the United States, but as I mentioned before, research and development is evolving. And there was, for example, a company that came out with an artificial intelligence program that helped identify a new drug for fibrosis in 3 weeks. Well, if that's the case, why would we need to provide 12 years of protection? So let's see where the debate evolves in the United States. And let's leave all of the options on the table to help bring greater competition and lower prices to patients across the United States.
Talking to Jonathan Kimball from the Association for Accessible Medicines, a trade group representing generic drug makers, looking at a provision in the NAFTA replacement bill, the USMCA, that has to do with exclusive right to produce new drugs, limiting the ability of generic companies to get in the first handful of years, first 10 years in the case of this agreement, after a new drug comes out. An argument from the companies that develop drugs, Jonathan, is that the generic companies, in effect, get to be free riders if they get in the door right away. All the research and work is done with company A, then company B can jump in within however many years and start producing a product without having done that research.
You know, it's definitely not a period of as soon as the product comes to the market. We have a situation where every patent provided in the United States is for 20 years. Plus, you get an additional 12 years if it's a biologic medicine. So we're talking 32 years from the beginning part of that research before a generic or a biosimilar can enter the market. So the question I think we need to ask is how much time is enough? And given the challenges that American patients have to affording their medicines, I think it's fair to look at the monopoly rights that the government, in a sense, gives to the pharmaceutical industry and say, hey, do we need to change that? Do we need to find a better way to bring competition to the marketplace so we can see greater use of generics and biosimilars and see prices get down sooner? It just seems like it's a somewhat of a stale argument to continue to argue that generic and biosimilar competition needs to be delayed for as long as it is.
Magic wand, what would you make the right period for generic drugs to be available?
You know, I actually don't have an answer to the magic wand question because I think it's an evolving discussion and debate. And I think what needs to happen is in the United States is where that debate has to happen for our healthcare system. And the concern about enshrining this period of protection, this monopoly right into USMCA, is it would limit what that debate could be in the United States. And so I think there's an important conversation to be had. And I think it's also important to reflect that research and development evolves and will change. And while maybe in 2009 it took 12 years to bring a biologic to the market, as the process evolves and new technologies are brought to bear, that change is going to reduce. That time period is going to be reduced. So let's not come to the table with a set period now. Let's have that conversation. But I think we should have it outside of a trade agreement.
Now, this is a question about science and economics. It's also a political question. We have this completed agreement between the three countries waiting for ratification by both chambers of Congress. Is it too late? Is this just going to happen as it is?
You know, Mexico and Canada need the United States market a lot. I think if the U.S. comes to terms on a slightly modified agreement, Canada and Mexico are going to seriously consider what was presented. And in my opinion, they're going to accept it, especially in the area of access to medicines. The Canadian government, they came out right when the agreement was closed and said, you know, the one issue they regret the most is the time period for biologic exclusivity in the agreement. Similarly, the Mexican government has indicated that this is an area that they could accept changes to.
104 members of the U.S. House of Representatives sent a letter to the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer back in the summer opposing this provision. Do you think there's enough political pressure that this could actually change in Congress?
You know, when the Democrats took control of the House of Representatives in 2018, it was really thanks to the American public's concern about healthcare costs and specifically pharmaceutical costs. I think there is a clear support in the Democratic majority in the House, and I think also among some Republicans, that something needs to be done to rein in the price of pharmaceuticals. Now, it seems like it would be a little incongruous to then at the same time pass a trade agreement that would limit that right. So I do think politically there's an opportunity to make changes here in the United States because it really is it's what is needed to improve our system and allow greater competition in the space, in the pharmaceutical market. And I do think that both Democrats and Republicans will get behind that.
Jonathan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Jonathan Kimmel of the Association for Accessible Medicines, a trade group that represents generic drug makers. He was with us to talk about part of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement that he says protects brand-name drug company monopolies and is bad for consumers. We heard from former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson on the other side of that issue on Monday. Coming up, learn about how wet weather is hampering Wisconsin farmers' ability to spread manure and what they're doing as a result. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, frequent rain and saturated soil aren't just bad for harvesting crops, but for spreading manure, too. We'll look at the risks and how farmers across the state are adjusting. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about tradition.
Wild rice, or manioc, is a staple food among Ojibwe tribes. It lies at the center of their history on the shores of Lake Superior. For generations, tribal members have harvested this food that grows on the water. As WPR's Daniel Kading tells us, members of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa recently made the trek to Pequawong Lake in northern Wisconsin to pass on the tradition to tribal youth.
Bad River tribal elder Star Ames is shaving a piece of cedar wood to make knocking sticks that are used to harvest wild rice. As a kid, Ames would go out with her brother in black-bottom ricing boats to gather rice for processing. They would lay it out to dry and parch it in a cast-iron cauldron over a wood fire. Then they would dance the rice, using their feet to loosen the hulls. Now, around 20 youth from Bad River are harvesting wild rice on this off-reservation lake.
Most of the kids, I think, nowadays have had a chance to participate in the processing of the rice. This is the first time that they've been out on the water getting it themselves.
Bad River tribal members and guides are giving kids a tutorial before they head out on the water. 17-year-old Creighton Wolf is one of a few here who have been ricing before. She's chairwoman of the Bad River Youth Council.
When you go out in the boat, you're going to have two knockers, and you're going to bring, it's like you bring the rice down with one, and then with the other knocker, you're going to kind of scrape it down into your boat.
She first learned how to harvest wild rice with her mom and grandpa in the Bad River Kakagan Sloughs when she was 10 years old.
At first, I was all scared of the bugs, but it was fun after a while because they taught me how to do it right, and seeing them doing it and like having it pass on to generation so I can pass it on to my kids, that'll be a cool thing.
Here we go. We're launching.
Older kids who have gone ricing before pair up with those who are doing it for the first time. They paddle into wild rice beds, pulling plants toward them and knocking wild rice into their canoes. Bad River tribal member Faye Madej says it's important to connect tribal youth to this part of their history.
Anishinaabe at one time lived on like the east coast of the United States, and we are told to follow the mega shell to the place where the food grows on the water, and it was Manilin Island. And for me, having kids out on the water is like, in a traditional aspect, like, they're part of that story. They're part of harvesting that food that grows on the water.
The tradition has been passed down from generation to generation, despite decades of pressure to adopt mainstream American culture. 17-year-old Lauren Nellis says he harvests wild rice for his family and his grandmother, who can no longer do it on her own.
I think it's important to gather rice for, like, we have these ceremonial feasts, sobriety feasts, sometimes for our funerals and just a social gathering.
He learned how to gather rice in the 7th grade through Ojibwe school, but he fears the tradition is at risk of being lost among younger generations.
All these kids addicted to something, and they want to do something else other than learn about what to do with their rice, what to do with their culture, what to do with the tribe.
He says some are addicted to nicotine, some are glued to their smartphones or video games. Wolf says others party and do drugs. Lori Lemieux is the Indigenous Arts and Sciences Coordinator with the Bad River Education Department. She says tying youth to their culture is also a form of intervention and prevention for the tribe.
Our community is suffering from different epidemics, just like the rest of America. And this is our goal, this is our tactic and strategy, is to go back to pick up those bundles that were maybe left along the way.
Lemieux says sharing their knowledge with tribal youth ensures they'll be able to carry it forward to the next 7 generations.
WPR's Daniel Kading brought us that story. She's a reporter based in Superior. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, according to a dairy farmer quoted by a Green Bay TV station, this year has been the worst he's seen in terms of rainfall. The National Weather Service says the city has already broken last year's record for annual precipitation. Plus, the Midwest Regional Climate Center says several stations around the state measured record-high rain totals for September. Green Bay itself got more than 9.3 inches, topping the old mark by about an inch and a half. Aside from a lot of rainy days, the ground is saturated, which is making farmers hold off on spreading manure. The heavy rains have also contributed to problems with runoff. That's on top of other issues caused by too much water. Pam Yonke is farm director for the Wisconsin Farm Report Radio. She's also known as the Fabulous Farm Babe. Pam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, you betcha. My pleasure. And thank goodness we're talking on a dry day, at least for most of the state.
I was going to say, a lot of the state has had a chance to dry out at least a little bit this week. Is this helping farmers catch up?
Well, it is, most definitely. Right now, we're not focused quite as much on handling our manure as we are trying to get the harvest underway. You know, what you have to realize is this is almost a repeat performance of what we saw last fall. In 2018, many areas like Green Bay and other areas of Wisconsin saw record-setting rainfalls. And it's not just little rainfalls. It's heavy incidents all at once. So our harvest last fall got fouled up. The plans that farmers make as far as things like cover crops, which are basically crops they plant in the fall to maintain soil in place through the winter months and keep nutrients in place through the early spring thaw. We didn't get a chance to plant that last fall because we had so much rain. So this is a repeat performance by Mother Nature, and it's all coming home to hurt our Wisconsin farmers, both with the harvest and with some of their nutrient management plans.
Right, with the harvest, with the manure, with the cover crops, it's a race against the clock, right, between when the crops are ready to harvest and that first frost.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, we'll even take first frost. In Wisconsin, we learn to persevere even with Mother Nature against us. So it's not an end game if we see a frost or even a freeze. Once the freeze comes about, the ground is firm. We can get out there and kind of continue the harvest in many instances. And also when it comes to nutrient management, we have very select windows of opportunity to apply manure around Wisconsin. The bigger the farming operation, the more restrictions that they face. If we continue to see these heavy incidents of wet rain, you know, they're just constant, and like you said, the saturated soil just can't take it, then farmers are going to be forced to look at alternate ways of managing their waste. So the plans we've come up with in the past include things like, obviously, we've got big storage facilities on the larger dairies that are supposed to be able to compensate for 100-year rain and incidents like that. We also have a really fine staff of land conservation folks all around Wisconsin working in conjunction with the DNR and obviously farmers and their own professionals. If they can't get out on their own fields, they'll start working in the neighborhood to see if somebody's got a field that they can rent temporarily for manure management or figure out some kind of agreement that way. And I've seen where the DNR and land conservation staff have worked on trying to find those partnerships. So we are very creative and very perseverant in Wisconsin when it comes to working around these incidents, but obviously we'd prefer a nice, dry, long Indian summer, if you will, so that we can try to catch up on what we lost for the month of September.
I wanted to touch base on a couple other agriculture issues. Secretary Sonny Perdue from the USDA made some headlines at the World Dairy Expo in Madison. This was just last week. He said dairy farms may need to get bigger in order to stay in business, may not be a place for smaller farms. What's been the reaction since then, Pam?
You know, I'm glad you bring that up because one thing in talking with Sonny Perdue is they didn't finish the sentence. Everybody likes to jump on these quotes to sell papers or get a bunch of social media likes. But in reality, what Sonny Perdue was explaining is that this is a pattern we've seen in agriculture since I was a kid. You know, he said his dad put two kids through college on 318 acres in the middle of Georgia. But today that would not likely be able to happen. And that's the picture that he was painting. Today, agriculture is high capital, high investment, high expense business. And you just have to scale up if you are going to be able to compensate for the increased cost. Let's face it, does your health insurance cost the same as it did 20 years ago? Well, you have to compensate for those kinds of expenses, and that's what a lot of Wisconsin dairies have done. There were a lot of people in the room with Secretary Perdue that were nodding their head. They have already done pretty much what he said. They have gone from 75 cows to 150 cows. They saw this pattern a long time ago. So, like I said, I think there was some misconstruing of those few words, then they didn't put together the rest of the message that he brought. Do we like to talk about that in Wisconsin as a kid that came from a small family farm in O'Connell County? No, it's never pleasant. I don't like hearing about people that are having to transition after generations, but it has become a reality, not just in Wisconsin, but across the United States.
And also last week, the legislature's Joint Finance Committee authorized the release of $8.8 million for UW System Dairy Innovation Hub. That's going to be on three campuses. So what's going on there, Pam?
Yeah, so and that's pretty much a directive from the Dairy Task Force 2.0. One of the first things they said is, when Wisconsin's dairy industry comes under fire, we've got to get creative. We've got to fight for our market share. Last time around, when we saw that downturn in the 80s, we did just that. We started coming up with new ways to invigorate milk production, new ways to invigorate the different types of cheeses we produce. And now look where we are. We've got more than 600 different types of specialty cheese produced in Wisconsin, and we dominate that market. So what's it going to take to get us to the next level to keep Wisconsin America's Dairyland? So this Dairy Innovation Hub, which will be on the UW-Platteville, UW-Madison, and UW-River Falls campuses, will bring in new creative teachers, researchers, and also work on different labs that are in place, looking at different research facilities and trying to get those new flavors, those new ideas, new packaging, what does the consumer want, and make it a Wisconsin idea going forward.
In our last few moments, Pam, any other big farm news in Wisconsin you are keeping an eye on?
Well, you know, I guess I'm trying to keep optimistic. If we can string together these dry days, I have every confidence that my Wisconsin farmers will make it through the harvest. Then the hard work comes during our winter meetings when we have to really sharpen the pencil and see what 2020 is going to look like. Will it look as bad as 2018 or early 19? What I'm hearing from my guests on my show is probably not, but it's not going to be all roses either. So just about the time that we get things kind of wrapped up, it's time to hunker back down and look forward. But please, if you know, October is Suicide Prevention Month. I hate to bring this up in context of agriculture, but if you live next to a farmer, if you know a farm family from church, the grocery store, whatever, please pause and thank them for being a part of your community. Do something simple, like share some cookies and a note in their mailbox, something that lets them know that you're pulling for them as individuals in your neighborhood. I think that, quite frankly, can go a whole lot farther than a couple days of nice weather.
Pam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Pam Yonke is the farm director for Wisconsin Farm Report Radio. We talked to her about farmers' struggles with wet weather this fall and other issues facing farmers here in the state. Coming up, we look at what most people and both major political parties are getting wrong about Americans' beliefs about race and class, according to the author of a new book. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the latest news on measles in schools and the latest info about vaccination rates for kids. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, there are some commonly held ideas about where different groups of people fall on the political spectrum and their political attitudes. Working class whites, Republican, maybe solidly behind President Trump. People of color, solidly Democratic. The rich Republican, maybe educated whites, rural, urban. The story, especially when it comes to race and class and how they intersect, is actually much more complex. And our next guest says that just about everyone, from average Americans to high-level political strategists, are getting it wrong. Ian Haney-Lopez holds an endowed chair as the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at the University of California, Berkeley. He co-founded the Race Class Narrative Project and is the author of several books, including Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. His latest book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Delighted to be able to join you.
Well, you've researched and written a lot about race and politics. You've talked to a lot of everyday Americans about these topics, too. And as you write, you found that a lot of the sort of shorthands we use about people, groups of people in particular, really hide a lot of complexity at the individual and group level. What kind of things do you find when you go out and listen to people?
You find that there's a set of stereotypes that are fundamentally racist stereotypes about people of color as inherently dangerous and as undeserving and lazy, that are quite pervasive because they're very often expressed in dog whistle terms. And the idea there is these are terms that on the surface are silent about race. Think about a term like illegal alien or a term like the American heartland. or thugs and gangbangers, or the silent majority. You can't exactly pinpoint where race is mentioned because it's not mentioned. But these terms trigger these underlying racist stories about who's deserving, who's undeserving, who's hardworking, who's lazy, who's law-abiding, who's criminal. And what we found is once you start to use those coded terms, that they're so pervasive that they are convincing not just to a majority of Republican voters, and this is sort of a Republican political dynamic that gets started 50 years ago, so that's not much of a surprise, but they're also convincing to a majority of Democratic voters, to a majority of union households. And then you may think to yourself, well, this is really a racial story, you know, of whites versus people of color, so at least people of color won't fall for this. That's not true either. These coded messages warning about lazy people, undeserving people, dangerous, violent people, these messages are convincing to a majority of African Americans and a majority of Latinos as well.
You talk about an interesting kind of a mini focus group with a couple of, I think it was white working class guys who expressed some of those dog whistle ideas you just talked about. And in the same conversation expressed what people would consider very anti-racist attitudes. At the same time, we contain a diversity of perspectives, even within ourselves as individuals.
So I got to say that this is huge and really good news, but I also want to say it's really surprising. So I'm a professor who studied racism for 25 years now, and I too had this assumption that, you know, there's a lot of racism out there, and that you know, when we start trying to figure out how we're going to deal with it and push back against it, we're gonna find racist ideas. And we did, right? We started this focus group. We did this national research project. We did focus groups with whites, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Somalis. And as we talked to different people, we encountered a lot of stereotypes. But the thing I did not appreciate, and this is really revelatory, the thing I didn't appreciate is that most people, they're not just one thing. People are complex, and they are toggling between deeply racist stereotypes on the one hand and racially egalitarian views that really recognize the beauty of seeing our humanity in each other's smiles. And I didn't know that. And, you know, to make it more concrete, we start this project trying to figure out how to push back against racism in politics by talking with a couple of white guys in Ohio, and they said some racist stuff, right? The welfare queen stuff, and you can't go into certain neighborhoods, and it just happens to be black and brown, and you're not safe. And, you know, and I was thinking, we're dead. How are we going to do this? And the more they kept talking, they also started saying things like, you know, but my children, my daughter, she's got a black baby doll and she didn't realize the difference. And it's just beautiful. And I use that as the image for my Facebook page. And so here you have this person who, on the one hand, expresses some racist stereotypes. And on the other hand, clearly embraces an ideal in which we recognize each other's humanities unburdened by racism in a way that really is just that believes in the solidarity of human beings. People are going back and forth between both. And that's really good news because it means that in this era in which there's so much racist stereotyping going on, in which there's so much racial division, our task as people who want to build a healthy society is not to tear down a mountain of racism, but it's to convince people that the racially progressive views they already hold, that it's their racial hopes that can help move them and their families forward.
Talking to Ian Haney-Lopez, his new book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. And you, Ian, have a project in this book. You're trying to figure out how to reach out in the conversation about race and about class and develop it into, in effect, a progressive political movement. What do you think about the way the Democratic Party talks about race and class, sometimes as opposing issues?
Yeah, they really do think of them as opposing, or at least as very separate issues. And so it's quite common to hear Democrats say, hey, we need to do racial justice and we need to promote economic fairness. We're going to do both, But to really treat them as different and indeed as aimed at different audiences. There's a racial justice conversation that happens with communities of color. There's this economic populism that happens with the white audiences. It's just there's an enormous mistake here. And I want to signal this is a mistake I used to make. In fact, this is a mistake that was fundamental to how I thought about racism for many years as a scholar of racism. The fundamental mistake is to think about racism as more than anything else, a conflict between whites and people of color, that there's some sort of war between these racial groups. There is that conflict. We need to deal with it as a society. I'm not denying that that conflict is there. But why is there so much conflict? What's behind it and who benefits from it? This is the perspective that completely changed for me when I began to study the way in which racism is purposefully used in politics, because it turns out some of the most powerful, wealthiest forces in our society, segments of our society, intentionally promote racial division. And in this way, race and class aren't separate. If you think about the party of big business, or you can think about somebody like Donald Trump as this billionaire who wins power as a man of the people, how did Trump win power? Well, he ran on a campaign that stressed themes of racial division and racial fear. And then he's turned around and governed in a way that has passed a massive tax cut for the biggest corporations and the wealthiest families. The issues of racial division and wealth inequality and the way in which all of the, as the economy grows, all of the benefits are going to the top 0.1%, those are not separate issues. They're the same issue, because racial division is precisely the way in which people are distracted from focusing on how government and the economy increasingly work for the very wealthiest.
How do you bring up the conversation about race? You write in your book that often when people point out racial inequities or racially charged, they say, political messages, you say they're met with accusations that bring up that issue is in itself racially divisive.
That's it. That's exactly right. So think about how this conversation goes. We started already by saying, hey, when these messages are expressed in code as illegal aliens and the American heartland, the majority of people agree with it. And the majority of people means the majority, including Democrats and African-Americans and Latinos. So now if progressives turn around and say, hey, you know, people, when they talk about illegals in the heartland, that's racist. Most people think, that doesn't sound racist to me. That sounds like common sense. And if you're saying that's racist to a politician who says that, you're kind of saying I'm racist. And I'm not racist. I'm just worried. Right. And so what happens is we get stuck in this sort of feedback loop where politicians who are exploiting dog whistles are intentionally triggering racist stereotypes, but they're doing it in a way that allows them to deny that that's what we're doing. So then when we call them out and say, no, that's racist, they say, I didn't say any racist thing at all. There's nothing. I didn't mention race at all. But you called me a racist, and that's racist against me. You're stereotyping me. And they win because their basic claim is we are a country in which racial groups are at each other's throats. And if that's how most voters go to the polls, then they will tend to vote for their racial team. That's the plan. Convince people that elections are really about electing your racial team. And so the way to break out of that is to say, you know what? Racism is really a weapon that's being used against all of us. It doesn't hurt us all in the same way. It doesn't affect us in the same manner to the same degree. But it's a weapon against all of us. And we lose when we think that we're on a racial team and that our enemy is the other racial team. We win when we recognize we're all in this together, and that the people who threaten us are the people who intentionally stoke division so that they can hijack government and the economy for themselves.
We're talking to Ian Haney-Lopez right now, professor of public law at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class Winning Elections and Saving America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think other people make assumptions about your beliefs based on your race, your occupation, your education, maybe your age or where you live? Do you feel like you're expected to hold a slate of beliefs that are thought to belong to one party or the other? What do you think about what our guest is saying about how racial language, sometimes he says coded dog whistle language, is used in American politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how the main political parties have used race and class to make assumptions about people, about voters, and how they may have gotten it wrong. Ian Haney-Lopez is with us. His new book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like either or both political parties assume that they have your support or ignore you based on who you are, racially, class, whatever? Do you see more diversity in your own opinions and those around you than the media or politicians pay attention to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Christine is with us in Eau Claire. Christine, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Christine?
Well, in terms of being judged, maybe that's not the question, but as an independent parent, single parent, I have definitely been judged. And my daughter has also been judged. And so I know I'm white, my daughter's white, but I feel like in the same way that people get judged or thought less of, are less than in terms of race, we have the same thing as a single parent. Even though I do have a college education, I've worked all my life, but I haven't made a lot of money, and we struggle, but that doesn't mean that we're not good people or have the same dreams and aspirations that others do.
Christine, thanks for the call. Ian, you focus mostly in your book on race and class. Do you see similar things going on with gender and family type?
Yes, very definitely. Though I would think about Christine's comments through the lens of class and what is the story that we're telling? So it's important to remember, and Wisconsin is the place to remember it. It's important to remember that 100 years ago, there used to be a story about class that said, hey, you're all on your own. Real men work hard and provide for their families. Real men don't need help. They don't need to join unions. They don't need help from the government. Go ahead and negotiate with the big boss. That was the sort of rhetoric that was used 100 years ago before the Great Depression. Then you get the Great Depression and people are like, that's a load of baloney. We're really in this together. And like Christine, there are a lot of people who are working really hard. And it depending on where they live, what jobs are available, the transportation network, they may or may not be able to make ends meet. And it's not a matter of whether they're working hard. And people understood that in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. What happened that since the 70s, we've lost that sense that a lot of working class folks and a lot of poor folks of whatever color, whatever gender, are working hard and are good and deserving people, and that we should take care of them through government programs that provide routes of upward mobility? How do we lose that? We lost that through a racial story that said, no, the people who are poor are actually undeserving because they're lazy. And you know what proves it? Look at how many African Americans are poor. You believe racist stereotypes about them. They're lazy, right? That just proves that the market works. And look at the middle class. Isn't the middle class white? Doesn't that prove that if you're hardworking, you can make it? And it's hard to see, but behind our stories about poverty reflecting character and a lack of discipline and the middle class status or upper class status reflecting hard work more than anything else, behind those stories, there's a racial logic. And we all lose when we accept those racial, when we accept that racial logic. That's the racial logic that has caused people to turn against welfare, that caused so many states to oppose the Affordable Care Act, to ridicule it as Obamacare and reparations. But we all lose, right? There's assistance and programs and transportation and resources and childcare. There are things that Christine needs that we as a society used to provide, but we don't tend to provide it anymore because so many people have been convinced that people who are poor have nobody to blame but themselves. That's what we have to get beyond. And the way to get beyond it is to realize all of this language of racial division is really a weapon against all of us and how it changes our views of other people in our society who are working hard and really do, like Christine says, really do have the same aspirations and dreams all the rest of us do.
Christine, thanks for that call. Now, in the news this week, you're talking about, Ian, racial divisions being used as kind of a lever in American politics. Another party came to the same conclusion. It turns out Russian hackers. The U.S. Senate reports that the Russian interference campaign on U.S. social media really focused on racially divisive messaging. What do you make of that?
I think it is a sad commentary on how racial division is an Achilles heel for the United States. It is easily available to be exploited. Listen, Here's what I want to say, because this is very important. I think that a lot of people will react to a claim that says racial division is being intentionally used in our politics in a very defensive way. And partly the defensiveness is a sense of like, oh my gosh, you're accusing me of being a racist because, you know, I'm participating. No, I want to be very clear about this. Race is complex. We all have, if we've grown up in the United States, I as a Latino too, if we've grown up in the United States, we've internalized some ugly stereotypes. But we also understand that racism is a moral wrong, and in the ideal society, we would get beyond race and really take care of each other. What we also need to understand is that we have political leaders from both parties who sense that they can actually stir fear and anger and get people out to vote for them by promoting racial division. And this is not, there's nothing radical or revolutionary about this. This is what's been happening. And it's so commonplace. It's such an ugly aspect of what politics can be that Russia can figure this out, that you can see this happening in Western Europe. You can see it happening even in the Philippines, even in Brazil. Politicians have the ability to win power by stirring fear and hatred in the public. That's just humanity. It happens here. It happens all over the world. In turn, if we're going to stop them, we need to hold on to our fundamental ideals that we are all in this together, that we're all created equal, that government is by and for the people. And we need to work purposefully to make those ideals real by reaching across the very divisions that some politicians tell us pit each other at each other's throats.
We'll leave it there. Ian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Delighted to join you. Thank you so much.
That's Ian Haney Lopez, professor of public law at the University of California, Berkeley. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the clothing chain Forever 21 filed for bankruptcy. That is just the latest shakeup in the retail world. We'll get the latest on retail and ask you, where do you go clothes shopping? New research shows that children who are bullied can experience long-term changes in the way their brains develop. A Wisconsin pediatrician joins the show to look at that report and the science of recovery from long-term trauma. And a state lawmaker tells us about a plan to fully fund 4-year-old kindergarten in Wisconsin, and we'll get an update on how it is implemented in schools around the state. All that and look at some of the top news of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, the 911 emergency contact system is in the midst of a big upgrade in Wisconsin and around the country. Kate's guests tell us about the latest efforts to update 911 technology. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the issue of high-speed rail has been the topic of heated debate for decades in Wisconsin. A brand new podcast from WPR looks at the history and future of commuter rail in our state. It's called Derailed. We'll get a preview coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Thank you.